Okay, David Katz has arrived, and we've still got a bit of time. So I'd like, David, if you could give us a 10-minute presentation, and thank you very much. David is the director of the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center in the United States.
Bonjour tout le monde. Je m'excuse, j'avais l'impression que ma présentation était à 10h30. Donc, forgive me, please. Food value, right. Bon matin. Je vous remercie pour cette occasion de partager quelques pensées au sujet de la valeur de la nourriture. And I suppose I should continue in English. We'll talk briefly about food value this morning. I thank you for the opportunity to do so. And in essence, this does come down to ways of putting our money where our mouths are. And here's what we'll cover in the next 10 minutes. So this will be a rather brisk sprint. And once again, my apologies for shuffling your schedule. First, we'll get a clue. We'll go on a shopping spree. We'll get a price check at aisle 3, discuss trust but verification, dispense with an urban legend, deal with the produce problem, and conclude with an admonition for new math. First, getting a clue, the tale that I was asked to convey this morning actually begins with a school-based nutrition education program called Nutrition Detectives, developed in my lab. This is a freely available program, and consequently, because it's easy to do, it's very streamlined, it's in thousands of schools. I know it's in some schools in Canada, it's in schools throughout the U.S., we've translated it into Spanish. And in essence, what this program teaches is food label literacy targeted to the elementary school age group. Teaches the children to be clued into health, so the importance of the link between diet and health. And I thank my colleagues. I, of course, would not impose upon you to show a gratuitous picture of my family, but they are, in fact, my collaborators in this program. We teach the children why food matters, and since I only have 10 minutes, I can't belabor this. But generally what I do is call a child up to the front of the room when I'm teaching this to kids and ask how tall they are. And most recently, the child was Brandon, and he was about this tall. And I asked Brandon if he intended to remain that tall, and he didn't. Apparently, Brandon will be quite tall someday. He's going to grow quite a lot. And then I asked him what he intended to grow that out of. And he gave me the stupefied look you would expect from a child in response to that question. And I said, well, let me make it multiple choice. We can grow extra Brandon out of A, junk, or B, good stuff. Never mind Brandon's answer, because it turns out Brandon was a wise guy. But I think the notion that the growing bodies of children are literally manufactured out of the raw materials from the foods they eat and nothing else resonates with children and adults alike. And suddenly the concept of junk food is no longer cute or innocuous, because that really is the building material for the body of the child. The other thing that kids get is that food is the fuel for fun. It's what they run on. And if they want to do the things they like to do, they need energy to do it, and that comes from food. So they get it. But then what we focus on is the clues they should use when choosing food and deciding what to take and what to leave behind. So the first clue, for example, is don't trust Madison Avenue. Look right past the nonsense on the front of the package. Use spy skills. Go to the nutrition facts and the ingredient list. So we ask, for instance, what they think this fruit drink is made out of. They guess fruit. We look at the ingredient list. Indeed, this is made out of fruit. Everybody's pretty happy about that. Then we say, okay, how about this fruit drink? It has pictures of fruit on it as well. We'll guess fruit again, but this time we're wrong. This one, in fact, is a chemistry experiment gone bad. My son Gabriel would like to know where exactly are the fruits in this fruit drink. It turns out there aren't any. So we tell the kids, if you see a fruit drink like this, pick it up, take it over to the produce aisle, nestling it in among the kiwis, being sure to make introductions, because they never met one another before. We teach them that the first ingredient is the most abundant or largest, like the mama duck in front of the ducklings. We teach them that sometimes it's not what it's supposed to be. Here it's sugar, and the product is a breakfast cereal. And this is something they should leave behind. Clue number three is to look out for hidden junk in food, partially hydrogenated oil, high fructose corn syrup, stuff that really doesn't belong in food that has a discernible link to the natural world. Leave that behind. We tell them that the shorter the ingredient list, the better. Look out for long ingredient lists. I'll give you an example. The ingredients, for instance, in spinach are... You get the idea. That's the sweet spot. So the closer to that, the better. Clue number five, in pursuit of whole grain. Lots of grain products to choose from, but where exactly are the whole grains and why does it matter? Well, we teach them it matters. Whole grains are proud creatures. They don't like to have all of their clothing stripped away. It leaves them naked and ashamed. And besides, having the whole thing really is important, rather like the difference between having a whole plane or having a refined plane. All right, so they understand that you want all the functional parts. The five clues fit on a refrigerator magnet. They go home to mom and dad. And we also remind them that the best foods of all don't actually have ingredient lists or nutrition facts panel. They're direct from nature, and that's an important point. But they graduate. They are certified nutrition detectives. This program is available, as I said, in its entirety for free, including an interactive DVD shot in a very nice production facility, all available for free, partly the reason why it's in thousands of schools. They look at this program. It takes a total of 90 minutes out of a school year. It teaches something practical, and it's free. Why not? And we have done an evaluation. Currently, we're revising a paper for the Journal of School Health, over 1,200 kids in the Midwest. We found statistically significant increases in the ability of the children to identify more nutritious foods, as well as that of their parents. One of the nice things about this is it's so simple and streamlined, it goes home. So mom and dad actually learn these clues as well and can put them to use. Then we said, okay, the problem here is that people know how to identify more nutritious food, but will they buy it? Because everybody believes it costs more. So we asked a research assistant in the middle of America, Missouri, to go on a shopping spree for us. Said, buy 120, 130 products in major food categories and make sure half of them satisfy the criteria of the Nutrition Detectives Program and half do not. And let's compare price. And in essence, this is lifted from the methods section of the paper, and that's what it says. Go shopping. Choose products that do and don't meet these criteria in all the same categories. And then we did the price check in aisle three and every other aisle as well. And so here you see the categories, bread, cereal bars, cereals, chips, cookies, crackers, etc. And for the sake of time, we can really just jump down here and see that the less nutritious food averaged $2.29 and the more nutritious food averaged $2.31. And the p-value is pretty damn close to one. So across the board, there were some differences, but summed up across the supermarket, no difference at all. More nutritious, less nutritious, cost the same. This is one of the takeaway messages, and I'll return to this notion before I finish up in just a few minutes. It is to some extent urban legend that you must pay more for more nutritious food. The issue is you must have the skill power to find more nutritious food where it hides. And if you do, you can find it without spending more. We didn't stop there, though, because we thought nutrition detectives is insular. We need an external metric to prove that what we say is more nutritious truly is. So we used the overall nutritional quality index, which is a story I told recently in Quebec City. And I won't give you the details, except it begins back in 2003 with a suggestion from me to the U.S. Secretary of Health that we needed a guide for overall nutritional quality, expressible in very simple symbols, ABC, 1, 2, 3. The federal authorities didn't take this on, so I convened these colleagues, and we did it ourselves. And I suspect most of you recognize names on this list. President of the American Cancer Society, David Jenkins from the University of Toronto, inventor of the glycemic index, past presidents of the American Diabetes and American Dietetic Associations, president of chair of nutrition at Harvard, and on it goes. We worked together for 2 years. We passed the baton to this group that now oversees the algorithm. The algorithm includes all of these nutrients, and the details of this are for another time. And the backbone of the Anki algorithm is a trajectory score, and just very simply, it compares nutrient density in a food to the recommended concentration of that nutrient in the diet. So, for example, if the upper recommended intake of sodium in a 2,000-calorie diet is about 2,400 milligrams a day,
That's 2,400 milligrams divided by 2,000 calories, or 1.2 milligrams of sodium per calorie would be the upper recommended concentration of sodium in a healthy diet. So we take the sodium in a food, divide by the calories in a food, divide by 1.2, and answer the question, how many times more or less salty is this food than you want your diet to be on average? Is this pulling your average up or helping keep your average down? We do that for all of the nutrients in the algorithm. We apply weighting coefficients based on epidemiology, because what matters about nutrient density is the association with health outcomes. We factor all that in. The algorithm looks a bit like this. It actually is about 20 pages of mind-numbing computer programming in the SAS language. It is a commercial program at this point. The science, however, is completely walled off from the business. It's owned by a Yale-affiliated nonprofit community hospital. The funding to develop the algorithm came from there as well. But the commercial program is called Nuval. It's currently in 526 supermarkets in 18 states in the U.S., and more will be rolling it out in early 2010. You can get more information about this at Nuval.com. It expresses overall nutritional quality on a scale from 1 to 100. The higher the number, the more nutritious the food. It goes on the supermarket shelf in front of everything. We score absolutely every food. We have a database of more than 35,000 foods. And our initial paper describing all of this is due out literally any day now in the American Journal of Health Promotion. And there'll be an accompanying editorial by Mike Jacobson, the executive director of Center for Science and the Public Interest, in case that's of interest. We have other papers under review as well. But for today's purposes, the importance is this. We use the overall nutritional quality index to validate the fact that the nutrition detective's clues identify more nutritious foods. So we scored the less nutritious and the more nutritious, and down this entire list, the more nutritious foods using nutrition detectives criteria scored higher on the Anki or Nuval scale. And if you look down here, the average score for the less nutritious foods under 15, the average score for the more nutritious foods about a 25 on that 100-point scale, and the p-value falls off the page. Okay, so we used a separate metric to validate that what we said was more nutritious truly is. So again, by these two metrics, we have a pretty clear indication that to some extent the notion that more nutritious food must cost more is urban legend. There is some truth in it, and in particular that truth resides here. So we have a problem with produce which really does cost more. Okay? But here's how I suggest we think of that in terms of a new math. Basically, we, nutritionists and public policy people, have bought into the prevailing metric of food value, which forever has been calories per dollar. Now, throughout most of human history, calories were relatively scarce and hard to get, and physical activity unavoidable. We have devised a modern world in which physical activity is scarce and hard to get, and calories are unavoidable, and both you and we on either side of our border have epidemic obesity. Increasing the number of calories you get per dollar in societies prone to epidemic obesity simply lowers the cost of getting fat faster. And by the way, both Canadians and Americans are then willing to spend a fortune to lose the weight that they gained at no extra charge. So I suggest we all wake up and smell the SlimFast. The notion that calories per dollar is a measure of food value is obsolete. And if we think of nutrition per dollar spent, even the produce aisle may represent bargains. So the two takeaways: one, you can literally get more nutritious food without spending more. But even when you spend more, if we look at a ratio of nutritional value per dollar spent, maybe you're getting more bang for the buck. And by the way, with the 1 to 100 Nuval numbers right next to the price on the supermarket shelf, we actually have the opportunity to create those ratios, nutritional quality per dollar spent. And I think that's a new way of thinking of food value. And it is more timely, frankly, than calories per dollar. And that's it. Sorry to get here late. I thank you for your attention.
Why don't we, if we have some questions, we have a few minutes for questions.
Sorry about that. I'm not mix up. No, thanks for squeezing me.
Hey, no problem. That's great.
Dr. Chosankui Campbell-Soup, Dr. Katz, a very interesting model that you have. My only concern is that when you do it in a computer model, where you divide 2,400 milligrams of sodium by 2,000 kcal, and you get about, let's say, 1.2 milligram sodium per calorie. are you not penalizing products that are low in calories? For example, most soups are around 100 kcal. And I can't see the population consuming low-sodium soup consistently on an everyday basis.
Right.
So did you add the taste factor into your model?
Okay. Very, very good, very interesting question, possibly with the exception of the taste factor at the end. Because, no, we can't – we didn't add taste because it's a measure of nutritiousness. And, you know, frankly – if you're measuring weight, it doesn't necessarily take into account volume. It is a measure of an important thing. It doesn't measure everything important. But a few responses about the ratio of basically the problem with nutrient density, namely that it's not just the amount of the nutrient that matters, it's the denominator too, the calories. So in a low-calorie product like soup, the same amount of sodium will be inflated. Well, first of all, a justification for nutrient density. If you think of how much eating we all do each day, what bounds it? It's not a fixed amount of volume. It's not a fixed amount of weight. We talk about daily intake in terms of calories or kilojoules. So in essence, that's the box everything has to fit in. And you could almost think of those, you know, when you have a fundraiser, they have those barbershop things that are filling up to the top. So, you know, we've got two pylons that we're trying to fill up. One is calories. The other is, say, sodium or calcium, whatever it is. If you hit the top of calories and you're done before you've gone over your threshold for sodium, that's a good thing. If we need 1,000 milligrams of calcium, you want to get there before you hit 2,000 calories. The only alternative would be to overeat calories to get enough calcium. So I think there's a fundamental validity to the ratio. But in a product like soup, first of all, we include in our algorithm energy density, and soup is richly rewarded for having a low energy density. Second, all of the numerator nutrients are also divided by the lower calories in soup. Consequently, the nutrients that come from the vegetables in vegetable soup create much higher ratios relative to calories than they would if it weren't in a soup, because that low calorie level is distributed across all of the calculations. But the other important consideration is the way this works in a supermarket. Primarily, it's a universal scale. You can look across all foods, but the choices people make tend to be within categories. So, for example, people are thinking about having soup. They're not choosing between that and an Oreo cookie, but they might be deciding which soup to have. Relatively high sodium content is consistent across all the soups, and so it's actually variation in other nutrients that determines the differences in scores, and there's a fairly broad range. But also, if you make your soups relatively lower in sodium, they don't have to be low in salt compared to foods in other aisles, but if you can reduce your sodium content somewhat and maintain palatability, it will indeed bump up your score. So, you know, I think the issue is addressed in a number of ways, but you're absolutely right. And by the way, just one last comment. Unlike any other nutritional guidance system, to my knowledge, we actually make specific adjustments for the removal of calories when sugar substitutes are used. We factor back in those calories with an adjustment coefficient so that the trivial amount of calcium in diet soda, say, doesn't get a very high reward because it's being divided by nearly zero calories. So we do address that issue. I don't know whether it's fully to your satisfaction, but it's addressed. Yes, it is. Again, the scores are available online, and more of them will be. What's that? Well, there's certainly a fairly comprehensive description of the algorithm available online. The details of it actually require a request. Most people couldn't read it anyway. As I say, it's in SAS. So unless you understand SAS computer language, the general public couldn't appreciate the full algorithm any more than the general public that drives a car would understand the blueprint of the engine. So, but for scientists, we share it routinely when they make that request to us. By the way, one last comment. Since you're challenging me to some extent, I challenge you back. Our preference for a given threshold of sodium is partly driven by familiarity. And so, you know, I don't think it's immutable. I think the fact that people find a certain level of sodium in soup or whatever else palatable is because that's what they've acclimated to. And I think incrementally we could dial that down and people would be perfectly content with less salt. We've gotten used to high levels of salt and sugar, and we prefer it because it's what we're used to.
for you. Guy Blissett with IBM, and thank you for your presentation. As
thanks.
A father of two young boys, very very inspiring, so I'll be reaching out to you. My question was just more about the model itself, and this discussion was sort of a great preface for my question, which is, do you find you're getting more traction on the measure with the retailers and retailers being interested in putting this on the shelf, or is it with the manufacturers who are searching for a somewhat unbiased measure? I mean, the manufacturers have a checkered past in terms of the measures that they're trying to apply to their food. So just curious as to where you're getting more traction.
Well, when I cooked up, first of all, you know, again, the Nuval system, I really presented it today simply as a means of validating the notion that the nutrition detective's clues worked to identify better nutrition as a way to judge the cost issue. So it's something of a tangent in today's discussion. And ordinarily, when I present the Anki algorithm, I devote the entire time to that, and even then it's not enough. The original model I had in mind was retail and internet. And manufacturers could come late to the party, although I thought what I refer to as the wholesome wholesale coalition. So, you know, the companies that make the most nutritious products, one that comes to mind is Nature's Path up here in Canada. You know, fabulous line of breakfast cereals, extremely nutritious. In fact, I think Nature's Path Synergy breakfast cereal, has anybody eaten that? And that may be the most nutritious breakfast cereal on the planet, so it's great. It's 8 grains, it's got no sodium, it's great. And it tastes really good. But, you know, essentially manufacturers like that make truly nutritious food are saying, we make really nutritious food. But every other company is saying the same thing. You know, good source of whole grain, fortified with 11 essential vitamins and minerals, part of a complete breakfast. I mean, nobody's going to tell you that it's not necessarily a good part of a complete breakfast. So, you know, you've got to figure that out for yourself. So I think those manufacturers could and should have an interest, and they do. And we're discussing this with them. But the initial business play, if you will, first of all, when we finished constructing the algorithm, the first place we took it was not to a business entity, but to the FDA. I actually sat down for 4.5 hours with a group of scientists at the FDA. And at the end of the meeting, Richard Williams, who led that group at the time and is now at Emory, said, this is the best half day of work I've had at the agency. But if you want to see this in the hands of consumers while we're still young enough to care, you probably need to find a business entity that can profit from getting it out there and then go. So the entity we found was a coalition of supermarkets, with the idea being that supermarkets, retailers sell everything, and if some products score well and some not so well, they'll be okay with that, whereas the big manufacturers might not love their scores. So I always assume manufacturers would be late to the party, and that is the business model. We're currently focused on retailers, but we have a number of manufacturers very interested, particularly those that make the most wholesome foods. Now, back to your notion that the manufacturers are looking for an objective third-party unbiased system. Well, maybe now they are after the Fruit Loops issue. But, you know, honestly, if you make a product that's not highly nutritious and you don't want people to be concerned about that, telling the truth is important, but maybe not telling the whole truth. And frankly, you know, our system tells the whole truth. It really is a summative measure of overall nutritional quality on a relative scale. So it tells you an awful lot more than makes the cut, doesn't make the cut kind of systems. And that's what, for example, Smart Choices was designed to be. So I hope you're right. I hope at this point manufacturers would be interested in this third-party adjudication. In which case, this was designed, unlike any other system, it was designed by a group of leading nutrition and public health scientists to be a gold standard. It wasn't designed for a supermarket. There were no industry ties. It's completely independent. So that's our hope, that we'll move in that direction. But retail is the concentration now.
Do you assess the retailer's own brand?
Yes, everything. Everything. And by the way, one of the reasons for retailers to sign up, since all of them have their private label and they can control reformulation, you know, if they are a client and have inside knowledge about what do we need to change to improve our scores, those products sell for less. If they also can have higher scores, they can position them to increase the percent of sales in that category, and that's profit generating. One of the retailers in the States that was going to start this in 2009 delayed because they wanted to reformulate their private label and make sure it always came out at least as good, if not better, than the national brands against which it was competing before they launched the system. So they're using it just that way. Now, from a public health perspective, that's a good thing. It means more nutritious foods are available at lower cost for the consumer. So the retailer wins. That's no skin off my teeth. The consumer wins, which is what this was designed for in the first place.
Right. One other follow-up question. Is there any litigation pending around this?
Well, maybe there will be after this morning. I anticipated a letter from Campbell Soup's attorney. No, and in fact, you know, there's a great deal of angst among attorneys. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of due diligence to be very careful. There's a lot of outreach. And the idea here really is everybody can win. Manufacturers can embrace this and say, you know, we really want to use an objective measure of nutritional quality. I think there's a halo effect. We can reformulate. We'll do the best we can to give you food you love, but that loves you back by being good for you. I think that's a good thing. But frankly, I think it would be so difficult to challenge in the court of public opinion. When you look at the scientists who came together to do this with no business plan in sight, that came later. It was really pure public health. There's been no challenge, I think, partly because of its pedigree, partly because the science really is as robust as we can possibly make it, and partly because I think it really would look bad to attack this. So, you know, we, the maker of some particular junk food, object to this measure of nutritional quality put together by some of the leading public health advocates in North America. So a lot of worry about it, but both outreach, dialogue, attorney to attorney, scientist to scientist, and the fact that it's relatively bulletproof, it hasn't happened.
I'd like to thank our two speakers.
Thank you.